Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunk. This is Hero White. Today we have an article by Kevin Carson, recently posted in the Center for the Stateless Society, c4ss.org, entitled Bitcoin, More Important Than You Realize. Then we'll follow that up with another article, Digital Cash and the Regulators, by J. Orlin Graby. Bitcoin, More Important Than You Realize, by Kevin Carson, May 20th, 2011. Neal Stephenson's novel, The Diamond Age, takes place in a future where encrypted currencies and e-commerce have moved most economic transactions into darknets beyond government's capability of monitoring and regulation, causing tax bases around the world to implode and bringing on the collapse of most nation-states. Encrypted currencies and darknet economies have been promoted by such thinkers as Daniel de Ugarte and John Robb as a real-world model for resilient communities in the impending age of hollow states. So you can imagine my reaction to recent news of Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. Jason Calacanis and his colleagues at Launch describe Bitcoin as, quote, the most dangerous project we've ever seen, May 15th, 2011. Not only is it, quote, the most dangerous open-source project ever created, but possibly the most dangerous technological project since the internet itself. It, quote, could topple governments, destabilize economies, and create uncontrollable global bazaars for contraband. The beauty of Bitcoin is that there's no central server network to shut down. Bitcoin is traded from one desktop or mobile device to another via public key encryption, sort of catching and prosecuting end users with harsh punishments, and we all know how well that's worked out for proprietary content companies versus file sharers. There's no way to stop it. There are currently 6 million bitcoins in circulation, with a total value of 40 million. Bitcoins are generated by a complicated algorithm, with a total of the top to top out at 21 million. After that, increases in exchange of goods and services will be offset by appreciation of bitcoins in value and deflation of Bitcoin-denominated prices. This fixed upper limit and requirement for price deflation thereafter is one ground on which Bitcoin has been criticized. Another is that since it's not denominated in a familiar unit of measure like dollars, it's confusing as an instrument of exchange for the average person. As an alternative currency geek, I'd add the criticism that you can only engage in Bitcoin-denominated exchange if you've already obtained Bitcoins from previous transactions. This is definitely a downside compared with the kinds of mutual credit clearing networks proposed by Tom Greco. Greco's mutual credit isn't a store of value from past transactions, just a measure of value for denominating exchanges of present or future goods and services. The backing comes entirely from the goods and services themselves. Like the many local barter networks that flourished during the Depression, Mutual credit is a system forces facilitating exchange even when there's, quote, no money. Despite my reservations, I consider Bitcoin grounds for enormous excitement. Pirate Party founder Rick Falkvinge calls it, quote, the Napster of banking. See Falkvinge.net, May 11, 2011. As Falkvinge argued, it's usually not the most feature-rich version of a new technology that achieves popular acceptance. Rather, it's the most user-friendly. Quote, it takes about 10 years from conception of a technology or an application of technology until somebody hits the magic recipe and how to make that technology easy enough to use that it catches on. Technologies for sharing digitized music have been around for 10 years when Fanning came up with Napster. Geeks had been sharing videos for 10 years when YouTube came along. Falkvinge thinks Bitcoin will do the same for encrypted e-currency. It'll do to banking what BitTorrent's doing to the music industry. Here's how Falkvinge describes the ramifications. The governments of the world are on the brink of losing the ability to look into the economy of their citizens. They stand to lose the ability to seize assets. They stand to lose the ability to collect debts. All the world's weapons and all the world's police hands are useless against the public's ability to keep their cryptographic economy to themselves. The decentralized, uncontrollable economy, where one lifetime employment is no longer central to every human being, is something I've called the swarm economy, and I predict it will redefine society to an immensely larger extent than the ability to get rap music for free. Unquote. This is vitally important to a central theme in my work, the emergence of non-state spaces within which the low-overhead, informal, and household economy can function outside the state's ability to impose artificial scarcities and entry barriers and collect tribute for the usurers, landlords, and proprietary content owners. Bitcoin is monumentally important. Encrypted currency has been at the Altair stage of development. If Bitcoin isn't actually the Apple II, and it may not be, we're still just around the corner from that level of popular adoption. We're going to read another special piece by J. Orland Graby called Digital Cash and the Regulars, part of a whole series of many of his writings from 10 to 12, 13 years ago. This article is entitled Digital Cash and the Regulators, posted on the net on February 15th, 1998. Digital Cash and the Regulators by J. Orland Graby. Digital cash, like other forms of money, can be issued in any political or legal jurisdiction or in any banking environment, Salt Lake City, the Cayman Islands, Cyprus, or Sydney. There's a great deal of flexibility available to the digital cash provider when viewed from a global perspective. Nevertheless, digital cash may operate locally under a set of rules and regulations similar to other forms of computer money such as bank deposits. Locally can be almost any internet-accessible country. The question of how banking regulators view digital cash is a practical one because the answers to the question demonstrate the sort of issues that arise in any banking context. All the examples here will involve the U.S., a country with a complex maze of banking regulations. From the point of view of central bankers, digital cash generates three sorts of questions. Who issues it? How is it used as a means of payment? What impact does it have on the banking system balance sheet or bottom line? Currency competition and seniorage. Digital cash is by design a partial substitute for ordinary cash. Hence, it will be used in much the same fashion as ordinary cash, a context with which central bankers are familiar. To a certain extent, digital cash threatens the profitability inherent in central bank note issue. Consider traveler's checks. Traveler's checks are a form of private bank currency. They're analogous to the bank notes issued by private commercial banks in the U.S. prior to the Civil War. As such, they are very profitable to the banks and companies that issue them, because no interest is paid out on traveler's checks to the check holders. But the issuer earns interest on the funds that customers use to purchase them. When you purchase American Express traveler's checks, you are making an interest-free loan to American Express. That's why Amex likes to sell them to you apart from the fees involved in the transaction. As with traveler's checks, digital cash products such as electronic purses, a card with a memory chip on it, represent an attempt by commercial banks to capture part of the seigniorage earned by the central bank from issuing notes. Holders of currency, Federal Reserve notes, are making an interest-free loan to the government. The interest opportunity cost adds up. The approximate $20 billion that the Federal Reserve turned over to the U.S. Treasury in 1994, for example, represented about 5% of the $400 billion in Federal Reserve notes. The Bank of International Settlements, BIS, estimated that in the United States, seigniorage is 0.43% of gross domestic product, while central bank Federal Reserve expenses are 0.03% of GDP, implying a profit of 0.40% of GDP. These numbers can be used as a reference to base to calculate the amount of seigniorage recapture available to providers of digital cash. Suppose that the digital cash was so successful for small purchases that eliminated the $1, $5, $10, and $20 bills. In that case, the BIS estimates the loss of seigniorage at 0.14% of GDP. Now, it is highly unlikely that digital cash would replace all small denomination bills, as assumed in this calculation. But the calculation shows that up to one-third of current Federal Reserve seigniorage is potentially available to digital cash providers, and that's a lot of money. While some central banks may be concerned that digital cash will infringe on their monopoly of issuing banknotes, although most do not appear to be particularly alarmed, such a monopoly can be easily circumvented without computers and without telecommunications. All that is required for the success of any privately issued currency is local acceptance as a means of payment for goods and labor. Consider, for example, ours, which is a local currency circulating in Ithaca, New York. Here is a brief, albeit dated, summary of the Ours system. Ours is a local currency created and issued by citizens in Ithaca, New York. The organizers have issued over $50,000 in local paper money to over 950 participants since 1991. An estimated $500,000 of in-hours-based transactions have taken place. The idea behind an hour is that it is a rough equivalent to a $10 bill. The unit was chosen because $10 per hour was the average wage paid in Tompkins County. Our notes come in four denominations and have been used to buy goods and services like plumbing, carpentry, electrical work, roofing, nursing, chiropractic care, child care, car and bike repair, food, eyeglasses, firewood, and gifts. The local credit union accepts them for mortgage and loan fees. People pay rent with ours. Some of the best restaurants in town take them, as do movie theaters, bowling alleys, two large locally owned grocery stores, and 30 farmers market vendors. Everyone who agrees to accept ours is paid $2, $20, for being listed in the newsletter Ithaca Money. Every 8 months, they may apply to be paid an additional $2 as reward for continuing participation. This mechanism increases the per capita supply of ours. Ithaca Money contains 1,200 member listings. Our loans are made without interest charges. Multicolored hours bear serial numbers and are printed on hard-to-counterfeit, locally-made, watermarked Cattell marsh reed paper. Naturally, our payments are taxable income when received for professional goods or services. The organizers have created a guide to creating local currency called a Hometown Money Starter Kit. The kit explains the startup and maintenance of an hours system and includes forms, laws, articles, procedures, insights, samples of Ithaca hours, and issues of Ithaca money. They've sent the kit to over 300 communities in 45 states. To get one, send $25 to Ithaca Money, Box 6578, Ithaca, New York, 14851. Hours, much like traveler checks, are an attempt to recapture a part of the currency seigniorage usually given up to the central bank. Like ours, digital cash does not require the approval of some central authority to form a viable mechanism, and the presence of seniorage means that digital cash products can be highly profitable, for they simply arbitrage the difference between the cost of producing digital cash and the return available to the issuers of the medium of exchange. As we saw previously, the Federal Reserve made $20 billion of this arbitrage in 1994, after payment of all expenses. Is digital cash, stored value, a deposit? U.S. banking regulations distinguish broadly between deposit-issuing institutions and others. Thus, the question whether the digital cash liability of a private company represents a deposit or not determines who might attempt to regulate it or whether it is eligible for federal deposit insurance. Some of these questions here are more important in a non-anonymous digital cash system than in an anonymous one. A depositor who is anonymous or who wishes his transactions to remain private is probably not interested in being identified for insurance purposes or receiving regular bank statements detailing his financial activities. But, that having been said, a look at some representative regulations is important for the purpose of understanding the political and legal barriers to the creation of an anonymous digital cash system. Digital cash is a balance sheet liability of the commercial banks or companies that issue it. Does it thus fall under the laws governing ordinary checking accounts? And what about discharge of debt? In the case of the U.S. federal law, does not currently, in the case of the U.S., federal law does not currently address obligations discharged by stored value cards, only those settled by cash, check, or wire transfer. FDIC deposit insurance, which applies to most bank deposits, can be easily extended to stored value cards under the guise of a general liability account. The FDIC General Counsel has issued an opinion that divides stored value cards into four categories: bank primary customer account systems, where funds stay in the customer's account until they are transferred to a merchant or other payee, as with a debit card. These are considered customer deposits and covered by FDIC deposit insurance. Bank primary reserve account systems, where funds are downloaded onto a customer's card or software, and the bank's obligation is transferred to a reserve or general liability account to pay merchants and other payees. These are also considered issuer deposits and covered by FDIC insurance. Bank secondary advance systems, where a card issuer is a third party. The bank makes the cards available to customers, and customers pay the third party for the stored value using funds from their bank account. The stored value funds in this case are not considered deposits and are not covered. Bank secondary pre-acquisition systems, where the card is issued by a third party, the bank pays the third party for the card value and subsequently sells the stored value to customers. Again, the stored value funds are not considered deposits and are not covered. Non-banks, meanwhile, are not eligible for FDIC deposit insurance. But the question remains, if non-banks issue stored value products, are these stored value funds deposits? For if stored value is legally a deposit, then federal and state regulators might attempt to deny a company or other entity the right to issue the product, using the Glass-Steagall Act or similar provisions. If stored value products are deposits, then a non-bank might also become subject to the jurisdiction of the Federal Trade Commission 12 U.S.C. 1831 TE, or might be treated as a bank for the purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act 12 U.S.C. 1841 C1. This is something to keep in mind before selecting Salt Lake City as your digital cash base. Nationally chartered banks are under the supervision of the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, OCC. The OCC has explicitly approved national bank participation in one digital cash system, MONDEX, and in stored value systems generally, stating, quote, "National banks may under 12 U.S.C. 24/7 engaged in the business of MONDEX USA," and also that "National banks may under 12 U.S.C. 24/7 engaged in the business of operating a stored value system." In addition, the Federal Reserve has authorized bank holding companies who own ATM networks to provide stored value card systems through these networks. A closer look at MONDEX. MONDEX is known as a stored value card system. Stored value simply means the money is stored on a memory chip on the MONDEX card instead of, say, being stored as pieces of paper in your wallet. This stored value will be used in everyday purchase and sales transactions just like cash. Hence, the chief function of the stored value is as a medium of exchange, and not, as the name might imply, as intemporal savings, which is the usual meaning of the phrase store of value in economic discussions of money. The rights to Mondex are held by Mondex International Limited, a UK limited liability company. 51% of Mondex International is owned by MasterCard International, while a consortium of global banks own the other 49%. The U.S. rights to Mondex have been purchased by a group of nationally chartered U.S. banks listed below. These U.S. banks have in turn formed two Delaware limited liability companies to operate Mondex. One of these two companies will act as a bank. It will create, sell, and redeem the electronically stored value, ESV, on Mondex cards. That is, it will trade other forms of U.S. dollars for stored value on the Mondex card. It will issue, sell, ESV for dollars, and it will redeem, buy back, ESV in exchange for dollars. ESV is thus just another form of money. Dollars, if denominated in dollars, pounds, if denominated in pounds, and so on. From now on, we will simply call the Mondex ESV Mondex dollars. The Delaware company acting as the bank is called an OLLC, Originator Limited Liability Company. Its liabilities will be the Mondex dollars it issues against payment. The money the OLLC receives will be invested in U.S. government securities and cash equivalents such as interbank deposits and overnight repurchase agreements. These are the OLLC assets. The holdings of cash and cash equivalents is required in order to be able to redeem Mondex dollars on demand. The second Delaware company will act as a licensing and servicing entity. The equity in the two companies is divided up between Wells Fargo, 30%, Texas Commerce Bank, 20%, First National Bank of Chicago, 10%, AT&T, 10%, Novus, 10%, and MasterCard, 10%. In granting these nationally chartered banks the right to operate a subsidiary which carries out digital cash operations, the OCC applied four criteria. 1. Is the operation related to banking? 2. Do the banks have sufficient control to disallow non-banking activities? 3. Is the bank's loss exposure limited? 4. Is the investment related to the bank's ordinary banking business? Since the OCC determined that the answers to these four questions were all yes, it approved the Mondex proposal. Regulation E. The Federal Reserve's Regulation E implements the Electronic Fund Transfer Act, EFTA. Under the guise of consumer protection, Regulation E requires various disclosures related to electronic funds transfer, as well as advance notice of changes in terms, transaction receipts, periodic statements, error resolution procedures, limitations on consumer liability, and restrictions on unsolicited giving of funds, transfer access devices to customers. On May 2, 1996, the Federal Reserve proposed to extend Regulation E to stored value cards. It would classify stored value systems as online, offline, accountable, or offline, unaccountable. Online systems would be simple debit cards where account balances are stored in a central database, not on the card, and communication with the central facility is required for balance transfers. Offline accountable systems are ones in which balances are recorded on the card, transactions do not have to be transmitted to a central facility to be pre-authorized, but where each transaction is stored and periodically transmitted to a central facility. Offline unaccountable systems are those in which transactions are not pre-authorized, transactions are not traceable to a particular card, and the card's value is only recorded on the card itself. The Fed proposes to make both online and offline accountable systems subject to Regulation E requirements on transaction receipts and dispute resolutions if the maximum value that can be loaded is greater than $100, but exempt if the maximum value is $100 or less. Offline unaccountable systems allowing values greater than $100 would be subject to the Regulation E requirement on initial disclosure, but would be totally exempt with respect to payment transactions. Online systems allowing values greater than $100 would have to meet all requirements of Regulation E, except for periodic statements provided an account balance and account history is available on request. The Fed's proposal would thus seem to eliminate online anonymous systems because of the transaction history requirement, but would allow for offline anonymous systems under the offline unaccountable option as long as account withdrawals were recorded. A digital cash system like Mondex operating out of Delaware has to grapple with all these issues. This has the advantage that, having made the regulators happy, the Mondex owners can then aggressively market their product through all the usual banking and financial channels. Those who are looking to create a digital cash product where privacy and security are paramount would probably want to go offshore and avoid the regulators to a great extent. But they will still be left with the more important and practical problem of making their customers happy. And they will still be looking to recapture some of the central bank seigniorage. Digital Cash and the Regulators, J. Orland Graby, 1998.
Here comes. dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.